Welcome to How I Lawyer, a podcast where I talk to attorneys from throughout the profession about what they do, why they do it, and how they do it well. I'm your host, Jonah Perlin, a law professor in Washington, D.C. This episode is sponsored, edited, and engineered by my friends at LawPods. LawPods is a professional podcast production company focused solely on attorney podcasting. I absolutely love working with them, and if you're considering becoming a legal podcaster or just want to learn more, check them out at lawpods.com. And now, let's get started. Hello, and welcome back. In today's episode, I'm excited to speak with Scott Oliver. Scott is a partner at Lewis Kappas in Indianapolis, where he represents banks and non-bank lenders in SBA transactions nationwide. Scott became the youngest equity partner in his firm's history after closing thousands of SBA loans and has counseled clients at every stage in the lending process. In addition to his busy practice, Scott is a frequent speaker on business development, personal branding, and supporting the human side of practice, including being a husband and father. Scott's an adjunct professor at the Indiana University Robert H. McKinney School of Law, where he teaches legal communication and analysis. He's a graduate of Purdue University, go Boilermakers, and Indiana University Law, go Hoosiers. On a personal note, I've loved learning from Scott in his public posting, and I'm so grateful that we get to hang out on here and that you all get to listen while we do so. So thanks for being here, Scott. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much, Jonah. I'm really excited.
Awesome. So let's just dive in and start talking about your decision to become a lawyer. So when and why did you decide to join our profession?
So it starts with a little bit of a funny story and then gets a little more serious. But I always tell people that the decision to become a lawyer started about junior year of high school, but it wasn't for the reasons that you'd think. My girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife, actually was always talking about how she wanted to go to law school. And I said, well, if she wants to go to law school, I should impress her. I should want to be a lawyer too. So I kind of said that to people, kind of put it out there in the universe, not really knowing what that meant.
Right.
But then followed it through when I went to Purdue University and said, well, I need to take these classes because this is what lawyers do or aspiring lawyers do. But at that point, it kind of started to solidify my choice to actually do the thing because I figured that the types of skills that I was developing, the things that I felt like I was good at, the things that I enjoyed, all kind of pointed to, hey, you might be good at practicing law. So I started immersing myself in finding mentors, in finding classes, and finding experiences very early on in my undergraduate career as a freshman to kind of take those stepping stones towards law school. When I got to law school, I was a little bit naive, as most first-year students can be when it comes to the practice of law.
Yeah.
I told everybody that I wanted to be a litigator because I saw myself speaking to a courtroom. I saw myself in there like you see the lawyers on TV.
Sure.
That's kind of what I wanted to do, to be in the spotlight there. So my first job in law school was actually for a really well-known plaintiff's personal injury firm here in Indianapolis, and I loved the firm. Loved the people, actually pretty much loved the work, but it really wasn't my skill set.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of like trying to fit a square peg in a round hole. I didn't necessarily feel like I was finding my fit.
Sure.
And it wasn't until I actually did the summer associate program at the firm I'm at now, Lewis Kappas, that I really did find my fit.
Wow.
So our firm has one of those summer associate programs where you rotate around in every department. And I sort of landed in my niche. We'll use that term a lot today, I feel, but landed in that niche by finding mentors who said, you know, have you tried corporate law? Have you tried lending and finance? And by the way, there's this thing called SBA lending out there that's up and coming. It's been around forever, but I think you might be a good fit. Once I found that, I never really looked back and just immersed myself in that and the people around it, similar to what I did when I figured out I wanted to go to law school.
Sure. And before we dive into sort of what that all means, because I'm really excited for you to share that, because I haven't had somebody with that sort of niche practice on the podcast before. I guess the two follow-ups I have is, one, as a college student, and I get this question, frankly, a lot, and I'm getting it more and more from college students, I think as you know, we're of this similar generation, but I think the generation, or I don't know if it's two generations behind us, whatever it is, those students who are going to college or starting college now, I'm getting more and more questions from them like, how do I figure out if I want to be a lawyer while I'm in college? And even more importantly, I think I want to be a lawyer. How can I set myself up, not just for law school, but to be a practitioner? And I always struggle with answering that question for people who haven't started law school. So I guess I'm curious, what are some of the things maybe that you did or the recommendations you give based on sort of having known early on this might be the path for you?
So start with your first question. In undergraduate, when I thought that I wanted to be a lawyer, the first thing that everybody told me, and I still tell younger undergraduate students to this day, is find a major or find a set of skills that if you change your mind your senior year of undergrad, you're not going to be without a job when you graduate. Hmm. So something that's transferable, right? Because as your listeners probably know, you can have any undergraduate degree and become a lawyer. So it's not incredibly important what your major is, but it is important that whatever it is you're learning is practical skills that will help you in the real world. You get bonus points.
Absolutely.
If you figure out a major that can help you in the real world, but also kind of develops those writing skills, speaking skills, analytical skills, things like that, that will help you succeed in law school. So there are majors that you hear about frequently of undergraduate students because they're taking those steps. They're saying economics is a very good major for law students, both because if they don't go to law school, they can find something.
Right.
If they do, you have those analytical skills that'll serve you well.
Yeah. And I think that's such good advice. I mean, one of the biggest questions I often get is like, what major should I do so that I can get into law school? And I'm like, that's not the right question, frankly, in my view. And it sounds like it's not the right question in your view either. It's what major can I do that either is going to speak to my skill set and my interests, but also give me those transferable skills, because your undergraduate major, at least in the American legal system, is largely irrelevant to being able to get into law school and then being successful in law school. So I think that's really, really good advice. And having those transferable skills in case you don't want to go to law school, really, really smart. The other thing that interests me in your early story is that you love the work of litigators, but decided it wasn't in your skill set. And I think there's this advice out there, and I think it comes from a good place of like, follow your passion, the thing you like. And it sounds like you sort of went to the thing you like and realized, yeah, I like it, but it's not necessarily my skill set. So talk to me a little bit about that tension and if that was hard and how you might instruct somebody else who's going through a similar challenge.
I think it was more the perception of what a lawyer does or what more specifically a litigator does. Because when I said, hey, I want to be a litigator, I was thinking of what you see on TV. I'm thinking of you know, somebody who's always in the courtroom, who's writing a brief from time to time, but most of the time really fighting for the rights of their clients and being in the limelight, so to speak. When in fact, a lot of litigation is taking a set of facts and working on a brief, maybe for a month or 2 months at a time with really no outside contact. For me, that doesn't fill my cup. I love writing. I mean, I teach it, right? I love legal writing. But if I had to sit behind my desk for 12 hours a day writing briefs 7 days a week, no, thank you. I'd rather do anything else than that. So when I figured I liked being a litigator, I didn't necessarily like what a litigator does on a day-to-day basis. And that's what a lot of law students or even young attorneys miss. They say, I want to be a lawyer, but they don't ask themselves, what does a lawyer do on a daily basis? Because that answer is night and day, depending on what I do or what my wife, she's also an attorney, what she did in her practice. It's completely different.
Yeah. I mean, I think that could not be better advice in my view of sort of thinking about what you do every day. And one of the challenges is that it's just hard to find that out. But it's, I know, something that you're posting about publicly. It's something that's the goal of my podcast. Is, as one of my very early guests, I think it was in the mid-30s, Brant Martin, who's a litigator in Texas, said on the podcast, he said, ask people, if I followed you around all day, what would I see? And if it sounds like that's the kind of thing that, to use your phrase, fills your cup, you might be in the right place. And if it's not filling your cup, you have to really look in the mirror. I think that's fantastic. Let's turn to a little bit about like what you do. And you said you had no idea when you started what an SBA transaction was. And obviously now you have this niche of providing legal counsel for banks and non-bank lenders closing SBA transactions nationwide. Explain that to me like I know nothing about it, because frankly, I know nothing about it.
Yeah. So when you are representing banks and non-bank lenders in SBA transactions, our approach is that we are essentially a partner in their pocket. We are the closest thing to being in-house counsel that we can be without actually being in-house counsel, okay? And there's a lot of benefits to banks and lenders to hiring outside counsel in these situations. But when we get the deals, we're with them from the beginning to the end, most of the time. Some clients will hire us for very specific things, but my bread and butter, the clients that I love, are long-term institutional clients where they're sending us volume year after year, and we're building relationships with them. Mm-hmm. To answer your question specifically, when a deal comes in, we usually see it when it's committed. So when the bank approves a transaction, let's say that somebody comes and says, hey, I want to buy a business in Arkansas. Okay, I want to buy an HVAC business in Arkansas. I can't do it myself. I need funding. SBA lending is a source of funding. The SBA lender gives them a commitment and says, we will give you X amount of money in order to acquire this business and give you working capital or some other source of proceeds, right? Mm-hmm. When we get that commitment, we review the entire deal. What does the customer look like? What is the business? What is their background? And what are they trying to do? It's the story behind the file. I love that portion of the deal. Mm-hmm. After that, we're building everything out for the bank. We're building out what do we need in order to close the transaction in compliance with SBA regulations. Additionally, what do we need in order to close in compliance with bank regulations? What do we need to know from a perspective of secured transactions? How are we secured? Whether it's by real estate, business assets, yachts, boats, parking spaces. I've done all sorts of different things. But we're with them to make sure that their collateral is protected. Because at the end of the day, if they don't protect their collateral or perfect it the way that they need to, they could lose what's called the SBA guarantee, which is if there's a default and they've complied with the bank regulations, they're able to get a portion of that money refunded back to them. It's the entire life of a transaction with that specific lender to get to the closing of a deal.
And if we zoom out a little bit on this kind of deal for someone who sort of, you know, I like the concrete example of you're buying an HVAC business in Arkansas. Who are the different players that you're working with and who has lawyers and where are the lawyers playing in this game also? Because I think if we zoom out, it makes this a little bit more concrete.
Yeah, there are a lot of different parties. Usually there's going to be a bank and a lender and the bank and lender's attorney. There's also a borrower who's receiving funds. That borrower, fingers crossed, hopefully, has an attorney. Then the seller also has an attorney. Okay, that's the core group. Mm-hmm. Me, buyer, sellers, attorneys, right? Outside of that, there can be any number of other parties. There could be a broker, a title company, an escrow company, consultants, all of these different parties that kind of have their hand in the cookie jar at the same time. So my job in some instances is to really just organize the transaction, get everybody on the same page, sketch out a game plan, and get the deals to closing as quickly and as accurately as possible. So when you asked about when I said that it didn't fill my cup to be a litigator because there really wasn't that much communication and interaction, what I do?
Sure.
Complete opposite. It's all about communication and interaction. And when you start to collaborate with all of these different attorneys and companies nationally, you see them over and over again. And the more that you can do that, the more you can work together to actually get a deal done, the easier it is. And it's what I call like the happy side of law, right? Everybody's happy when you get to the end. And, you know, it's all about that journey to closing.
Yeah. And what makes this different than sort of non-SBA or bigger M&A type transactions, the things you think about when you think of like the big law, New York City corporate attorney, what makes your practice maybe the same as those folks, but also unique compared to those folks?
Yeah, that's a really good way of saying it, same but unique at the same time. So the unique side of it on the banks is that we have this behind the scenes program or programs that we have to comply with. So there's
government programs.
The SBA program. There's a whole set of regulations for different types that has to be followed in order to get a deal done. So that presents challenges for the bank. It presents challenges for the borrower. Something that people say very frequently is if you can close an SBA deal, you can close any deal. Hmm. Because they may be smaller in dollar value. They are much more complex at times because of those hoops that you have to jump through. And at the end of the day, when you close that transaction, that business's file, its business portfolio, should be as good as it will ever be, because they've had to comply with all of these requirements. That's really the substantive side from it, that, you know, mm-hmm. the similarities and uniqueness. But the other piece of it is these are real people. I'm not saying that those multi-billion dollar deals aren't real people, but SBA transactions are small business transactions. Mm-hmm. They're mom and pop. They're your friends down the street. They're the people that are really the backbone of the American economy. So when we're working on these transactions, you know, they might only be $4 or $5 million. I mean, in the big scheme of things, that's not a lot, but this is their life. Their backs mm-hmm. are up against the wall. They're putting everything out there. And it's a very close relationship that everybody develops to get that deal done.
Got it. And if I were to sort of follow you around to take your own question and turn it on you, if I were to follow you around, you know, you've sort of talked about the life cycle of this deal, but if I were to follow you around on a given day, what kinds of things would I see you do? How many clients would I see you interact with? Are all your days sort of the same, or is there a cycle to them? What's that like? Read me into that.
Yeah, the days are all pretty different because these deals are all happening not at the same time, but they're all generally active at the same time. Mm-hmm. So at any given point, I'm reviewing files, I'm communicating with the parties, I'm coordinating closing logistics, I'm working with the other attorneys or parties that are involved in the transaction to get a deal done. That could be via email. Unfortunately, as lawyers, we send a lot of emails.
Okay? Yeah.
So there's lots of emails, but also phone calls, sometimes in-person meetings, but most of the time it's all done virtually because while our clients are usually, they could be startup banks and lenders or seasoned banks and lenders, but mostly the largest banks and lenders in the country, they're closing deals in all 50 states. And we're mm-hmm. not driving or we're not flying to those locations. We're there via Zoom, we're there via email, on the phone, all of those sort of things to coordinate a closing. So it looks different every single day. The other question you asked had to do with, you know, number of clients. I like to say that we have very focused institutional strategic clients. So we have quite a few, but my biggest goal is to take those clients and to build with them. Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's those deeper relationships. So it's not just I have somebody come through the door and says, I want to close one SBA transaction. I'm honestly not interested in that. I'll help you if you need it. But the clients that we like to see are the ones that come back time and time again. And we really build out basically a partnership with them in order to accomplish the goal that they're trying to do.
And one of the interesting things, because I was not a transactional lawyer, and so every time I'm asking questions, I'm sort of fearful that I'm like out of my depth. But one of the interesting things that I've heard from some types of transactional lawyers is the transactions themselves aren't all very different, right? If you're a capital markets lawyer, you're doing 1,000 transactions in any given quarter, and many of them are exactly the same using a standard form contract. And so you're looking at sort of 5% of each deal might be different. How different are these deals that you're working on? Are they really each unique? And are you drafting new documents for each deal? Tell me a little bit about how that works.
The structures of the deals, there's a lot of different structures that are eligible under SBA guidelines. You don't want me to get into that during this podcast. I'll put your audience to sleep. But there are a lot of different transaction styles. But generally, you're seeing business acquisitions, whether it's asset sales, membership purchase, stock purchases, etc., right? So those are the business acquisition sides. A lot of times, they involve real estate. Sometimes they'll involve business acquisitions and real estate. But at the end of the day, there's only a handful of different transactional structures. So to an extent, you see a lot of the same things over and over again, which is why experience is very important and why understanding the history of the SBA and all of its changes is very, very critical. But the place where you see a lot of variation is that every one of those deals, no matter if they're two asset purchases, they're never the same. Because it could be a different industry, a different state, a different county. All of these different pieces come into play. Add in that some of the transactions have very experienced attorneys involved, or not so experienced attorneys mm-hmm. involved, or no attorney involved, etc.
Right.
It looks very, very different. In a way, what keeps it exciting, because I'll be able to become, I know we can't call ourselves experts, but quote unquote, experts in certain areas that you never would have thought, like HVACs. I mentioned that before because I have an HVAC deal right now and I had to learn everything about an HVAC deal in a very specific state. That's new and there's something new every day. And with the SBA, it's always changing. Anybody who's in SBA right now understands that it's really changing right now. But that's what keeps it fun. That's what keeps it exciting. And add to it that you're doing good for the economy and everybody's kind of getting what they want out of the transaction. I wouldn't be anywhere else.
And there's always that tension, right, between expertise and being new at something, being creative and doing, having done this deal 1,000 times. What do you think lawyers, especially junior lawyers in your practice area, what are the lawyers that stand out and why do you think they stand out as being, you know, the people want to work with and work for?
That's a really good question. I think the biggest thing in my practice area is a junior lawyer who can take ownership.
Say more.
Yeah, that's not to say that they take over a deal and they never come to you for questions or anything like that. It's if they take over a deal and they're working on a transaction, there's always going to be a partner that's overseeing the entire thing. But I want somebody to come in and say, all right, I have this deal. Here's what I understand about it. I'm going to come in. I'm going to ask all of the questions. I'm going to do all the things. I'm going to be responsive and understand that this is somebody's livelihood that I'm dealing with. And I'm going to treat it like gold. So if I hand a file off to a junior level associate and they run with it and they're asking me the right questions, but they're also communicating with the client and the client saying, this is the best service that I've ever had. That's the person I want on my team. And those are the only people that I have on my team. Those people where the client can come back and say, it was an ugly deal. Maybe there were some bumps in the road, but at the end of the day, that attorney, no matter what their experience level, was responsive, was upbeat, was creative in their thinking, and treated the situation like they were the GPS of the transaction and not somebody who's just throwing up roadblocks all the time. That's the person that I want to work with me because that's the person that's going to have staying power and really treat the clients the way they should be treated.
And what's GPS for those who don't know?
So, you know, those things in your car that tell you where to go because you don't know how to read a map.
Oh, those kind of GPS, not a legal term of art. I love it. And I guess one of the things that I struggle with as a law professor and someone who works with junior lawyers all the time and summer associates all the time is I give the same advice that you give. And I hear other people give it of take ownership. The problem with the take ownership advice in practice is often if you don't have that experience and you haven't done 1,000 deals, it's really hard to both learn how to do something for the first time. And obviously, this is not something we're teaching people in law school by and large. And this advice of take ownership and run with it. And one thing you said that I think is really important is knowing when to ask questions and when to get help from more senior people. Other ways for sort of brand new people to both take ownership, but also get the experience they need to be able to take more ownership deal after deal?
I think it's getting in the trenches. So when you find something that you think that you enjoy, pinpoint a more senior attorney, a partner in that department, and sit them down and say, hey, I've pinpointed you as somebody who I really respect. I like your practice area. I like your style. I like the way that you handle clients and the way that you train associates, and say, take me under your wing. And say, teach me how to be you. I don't care if that means that I'm doing doc review for the first few months. I don't care what it is. I'll do it for you because I know that there is a bigger plan. And for me, that bigger plan, and kind of going off of an experience here, is when I was a summer associate at the firm I'm at now, one of the first big projects that I got wasn't necessarily directly with the clients, although I jumped in real quickly with that. It was actually just closing files. So I was literally sitting in a room with hundreds of closed deals, going through those files and ripping out staples and just making sure that every loan document was in that package and understanding what those loan documents were. The ownership side of it that my mentors would tell me about later, they would say, you know, when you did this, we thought that you were just going to do this and go home and get paid and, you know, have a nice day. But you did it. And then you came in and you asked why these documents were important. You asked what happens in a default scenario, you know, all of these different questions that let us know that you're not just here to get paid a wage. You're not here for a salary. You're here for the long haul to understand it, to own what you're doing, and to figure out how to come in and really make a splash in the industry that you're trying to serve.
Yeah. And I think that's the part that's often hard for people to learn. And it's why I'm so glad you sort of walked through that and told that story. I'm going to always think of that story of pulling staples out as a way of owning the case. Owning the case doesn't mean knowing all the answers. Mm-hmm. Owning the case doesn't even mean knowing all the questions, right? There is no task in some ways, especially when you're starting off, that is too small or unimportant, because by doing those tasks, you're moving the deal forward, or mm-hmm. if you're a litigator, you're moving the case forward, but you're also watching and learning and gaining a lot that you don't even know you're gaining by osmosis, so that when it's time for you to sort of play a bigger role, you have that bigger role. I think the hard part, especially for junior lawyers, is they come in, they think, I got this law degree, I sat for the bar, I passed the bar, give me a case, let me do something big. And there's that period of time, which is awkward and happens to everybody, when you've done enough to get to the starting line, but you haven't done enough to have that level of expertise and you can still own the case. Did I get that right?
Yeah, exactly. 100%. And it's not always, you know, what you think it cracked up to be at first, but if you're building that foundation, whether it's ripping staples out of closed deals or doing discovery, whatever it is, that foundation, you might not know it, but thinking back on it now, I just think, wow, my first couple of months, it wasn't anything sexy that I was doing. It wasn't an active deal, but I understood what a loan structure looks like. I understood what a note was. I understood what guarantees were. I knew the terms, the lingo of the guarantees. I learned bank terms. I learned how to talk the talk of my clients. I would then take all of that, those skills and that knowledge, to start venturing out into the interwebs and to social media to take complicated deal structures or topics and write them very, very simply. Wasn't getting paid for it necessarily, but I was writing complex things as simple as possible. And then I started sending it out to other people who were my peers or my age at different banks and saying, hey, I'm learning. I don't know everything. I'm not claiming to know anything. This isn't necessarily, it's not legal advice, but here's what I've prepared. Does this help you? Those relationships that stemmed just from the ownership aspects of ripping out those staples, they've paid off so much years down the road.
Wow. And let's talk about client acquisition, because I think that's something that, again, I get lots of questions about this all the time from sort of more junior listeners, people in their first few years of practice. And I think, again, maybe it's getting, people are feeling the pressure earlier and earlier to sort of get their own book or get their own clients. Talk to me about your path to building your own book of business and gaining clients at a pretty junior position as a lawyer.
I think the way that I did it would be what I would recommend to other people, and that is do the easiest barrier to entry first.
Say more.
So as a first or second year attorney, you're not going to go out and say, hey, IBM, I want you to be a client.
Right.
Come on board. They're going to laugh. You're not going to be able to do that. But what can you do is you can provide excellent service to the clients that your firm already has. Okay. So business development, people will say, starts with doing good work for partners. I agree with that to some extent, but to another extent, not. I think the work that you need to be doing is really quality work for the existing clients. Because at least in my business, a lot of the people who work lower on the totem pole at these banks and these lenders are the same age as me at the time. Mm-hmm. And if I'm building rapport, relationships, providing quality work and building that relationship deeply at first, they'll move around just like attorneys move around, right?
Sure.
People will move around. They'll go different places 5-10 years down the road. They'll remember, oh yeah, I remember working with that person. All of a sudden they can make an introduction to somebody at the new bank. They can make an introduction to somebody who wants an M&A transaction or what have you. And when they do that, they're just thinking about the work that you did your first or your second year. So it's a very, very long-term approach, but it's one that's easy to do as a first or second year that will pay off dividends in the future.
Yeah, I think that point of recognizing that there are often people at the client who are also junior and you can create a relationship with them, or if you're a litigator, the version of that I had was working with even opposing counsel who are also quite junior, and people move around, as you said, and having those relationships and not forgetting that you can provide value to the sort of general counsel, but you can provide value to the lowest level person on that totem pole, probably more value as a junior person. I think that's really great advice. How did you then transition sort of from building your business or building a book of business as a first year or second year to those, I might call them the dreaded years of like years 3 to 8, where you're really both, you both have enough experience to get a lot of work, but it's also prime time to sort of build yourself as you're building your firm and the partners at your firm's business?
It's something that it doesn't happen overnight and you don't really know when it occurs. But there was at some point in my career where I kind of woke up and I just said, hey, people are coming to me. They're coming to me directly for these questions, for these issues. And when that happens, you're still always going to have a little bit of a sense of imposter syndrome, right? We're plagued with that in our profession. But at the same time, you're confident enough to be able to provide advice. And if you're doing that and you're treating the client the way that you would want to be treated, right? The golden rule. If you're doing all of those things, clients come naturally. Mm-hmm. After a while, you also have to become known as a thought leader in a way. And for me personally, this isn't the same journey as everybody, but I like to do it through social media and through speaking engagements and through activities locally and nationally. When you're out there talking about the things that you do, why you do it, why you love it, and even the personal side of your life too, people are drawn to that. And when they can relate, they can see that authenticity, they'll come to you for the questions. When something SBA or M&A comes up, my name will pop into their head. You're top of mind. Once you have the clout to be able to do that as you progress in your career, it's easier to have those conversations. And that barrier to entry that I mentioned as a first or second year, it's not as difficult in your fifth through your 10th year and so on. It just becomes easier over time.
And what do you say to lawyers who are sort of skeptical of brand building through social media? Because I think there is a hesitancy by some lawyers. We're a pretty risk-averse profession. Many people are very guarded, and it's sort of like, no, that's not how lawyers act. They don't write about the cases they work on. They don't talk about issues on LinkedIn or on Twitter or X or Instagram or whatever the Pinterest, whatever the social media du jour is. What's your retort or response to that?
I would tell them they're wrong.
Say more.
I guess I wouldn't be so blunt. It's not for everybody. And there are certainly certain practice areas where it just doesn't work. Even in those practice areas where it does or can work, you have to be incredibly careful, right? Because we are all bound by the ethical rules of conduct.
Sure.
So if you are going to do it, read up on the ethical rules. Mm-hmm. Understand what you can and can't do. Don't divulge ever client information. Don't do the things that would get you in trouble. But it's common sense. At least it should be for most people. But at the end of the day, there was a post by Jay Harrington earlier this week or last week, right? You might have seen it, where he said that law firms will usually spend $500,000 plus on their website, and it will usually garner 100,000 clicks per month, right? Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Okay, $500,000 plus for a website that gets 100,000 clicks per month. Why not be able to do that in a day? And I see lawyers all the time who have built positive, good brands, good rapport with clients, good rapport with other attorneys and things like that, who will use social media for good, who will use it appropriately, and one of their posts will get 100,000 clicks about their practice, and it's free.
Yeah, I think that tells you sort of one of the ways to be a successful lawyer today in the 21st century is to have a positive brand that people associate with. And you're absolutely right. It is free. I mean, I've noticed it having this podcast because people are constantly pitching me to come on. And if you're listening and you want to come on, feel free to pitch me. I have too many people. I can't actually interview everybody. But they see this as a plus, an ability to talk about their story and who they are as a person and how they think about the law and how they think about training junior associates and how they think about working with clients. And if you can get that, why wouldn't you? I guess is the point, right?
Yeah. And at the end of the day, some egos out there, but there are hundreds, if not thousands, of lawyers that can do the exact same thing that you can do. That's humbling. And it should be. It's a sobering thing to say. Because we're in a profession, we pass a bar, we have skills. So many of us can do the same things. How do you stand out is a whole nother story. It can be how you handle clients, the service that you give, and all of that. But at the end of the day, too, social media, podcasts, whatever it is, puts you top of mind for clients, for other attorneys, et cetera. Good example with you, and I'm not just patting you on the back because I'm on your podcast, but I teach a class at IU every single year that you've been doing this. I go in there and I'll mention some names. They know who you are. They know who you are here in Indianapolis, Indiana. Same as if I am doing a deal and, you know, the borrower doesn't have an attorney and they need an attorney. I know off the top of my head people in my local area, but I also know people in other states who practice in other states just because I've become familiar with them online. I see their content. I see how they practice. I know what they do. I know their experience. There's this web of people's names who stand out in your head. Those people are much more likely to get that business than somebody else who's very, very quiet, dead silent, out in some firm that we don't know about. It's just a difference maker. It's a differentiator.
Okay, so you're hearing this for the first time and you're a first year associate at a law firm and you're thinking, that's great, Scott. You've been super successful doing all of this brand building. And I'll, again, thank you for my own brand building, which is shocking to me that even a legal writing professor is sort of out there. What do you suggest is the first step? If you've never sort of talked about yourself on social media or in private, that's just not your style. Where do you start?
Well, build out a profile first. You and I are both big fans of LinkedIn. I know mm-hmm. that LinkedIn gets some hate sometimes, but LinkedIn is the easiest because it is a professional network. You can build a profile 5 minutes.
Absolutely.
Build out that profile. If you don't feel comfortable posting, which plenty of people don't, and you never even have to if you don't want to, start connecting with people who you're familiar with. Connect with you, right? You put out content all the time and you don't have to post your own, but comment on somebody else's post. And again, it's another one of those
great advice
barrier to entry situations where it's scary to put yourself out there. It's very scary at sometimes, but it's not that scary if Jonah makes a post about his podcast and you listen to the podcast and you say, oh, I really liked how so-and-so said this in the comment section. All of a sudden, that person who was on the podcast might connect with you. Maybe mm-hmm. you have a conversation in the messages. Maybe you start talking via email and you figure out, hey, I like your firm. I like your style. It can lead to a lot of different opportunities. But eventually, if you do feel comfortable putting yourself out there, do it. But do it intelligently and do it in a way that is not violating ethical rules, that it's not violating any specific requirements that your firm has. Some mm-hmm. firms have really strict requirements. So be mindful of all of that. But if you can do it and do it well, I think that you will find out that it was a good idea.
I love that. And I think that's such great advice. And it's something that I've seen also. It's great. Start in the comments, right? Start responding to people who are already putting yourself out there because then you're part of the conversation.
Yeah.
And you don't have to feel like, oh, I have to have this unique individual thought to start the conversation, but you can still be a participant. One of the, I think, fears, and I'm sure you've experienced this as you've posted more and have more followers and all of those things, is sometimes people disagree with you or there's sort of negative backlash and there's this view of social media sometimes. And I think there are times when it's absolutely right where the person who is the loudest or has the most negative feedback is the one that gets the most play, as opposed to the people who are saying sort of the example you gave of, I listened to this and I really liked X, Y, or Z. How do you deal with that challenge of people disagreeing or you disagreeing or being a part of a conversation with people who you haven't actually met in person?
I don't see it too often, but that's because when I'm creating content, my content is usually not incredibly controversial and it's usually positive. Mm-hmm. The times that I see most of that negativity is when people post clickbait mm-hmm. or, you know, you're posting just to get followers or you're posting just to get reactions. And in those situations, people will pile on. Mm-hmm. In the rare circumstances that I do get some sort of negative feedback, I'll usually either respond if it's genuine negative feedback, but if it is just senseless negativity or just trying to get clout by commenting on a post or something like that, I'll delete. Mm-hmm. I'll delete and block. It's very easy to tell if somebody has your best intentions at heart or if somebody is just doing something to be nasty. And online, you will get those situations where there are trolls on your content, especially as you said, as you get more followers, but you can't let it get to you. Mm-hmm. And if what you're putting out into the universe, so to speak, is good and well-intentioned, most of the time, it's not going to phase you. And they're going to be the ones that come out with dirt on their face, so to speak, you know, kind of taking those punches for trying to bring negativity to your own thoughts, your own personal opinions about something that's legitimate.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with that approach. I take a very similar approach. If you have a generally positive approach to what you're posting, I think you get generally positivity back. And I think that's absolutely right.
It is hard sometimes too, especially in the past year or so with algorithm changes on Twitter and Facebook and things like that. You will see that people, and you can tell when people are posting because they just want engagement. And that's fine if that's what you want to do. But from my perspective, for an attorney, that's not what you're here for. You're here to either educate, help other people, or share experiences. You're not here to figure out what's going to rile people up the most and then watch your follower count go up. 5, 10, whatever, however many thousand followers it is compared to 1 million followers. 1 million followers is nothing if it's not your target audience and if it's not the right tribe that you want to build. Much rather have just a couple thousand followers in that instance.
Yeah, I like that idea of your goals being to educate and participate as opposed to just trying to drive up follower count. I think you're right. I think for lawyers, you know, there's this view that like all press is good press. I'm not sure that's right for lawyers in social media. But I won't speak for you. I'll just say for me, I think that makes a lot of sense. One of the things you said pretty early on in our conversation is that when you started doing this SBA lending work, people told you it was sort of a growing industry. And I've seen that also in your posts and other posts of others, that this is a big area of practice where we need lots of lawyers because there's just a lot of deals going on. I was curious if you could talk a little bit about where you think your industry is going, both generally and more specifically for lawyers.
I would start by saying, actually, when I started the SBA practice, people weren't saying that to me.
In fact,
they were saying, what's SBA? Or like, why are you doing this? And they would say things like, oh, you're pigeonholing yourself because it's an SBA program. What if it goes away tomorrow? Because it could. It's not going to, but it could. So when they were saying that, I personally felt that it was going places. And so far, thankfully, I've been correct in that. Because there's this huge emphasis on small to medium-sized businesses. And I think half of it has to do with the fact that these are the backbone of the economy. Like I said earlier, they're mom and pop. They're the people who are the real people that are wanting funding, right? So there's this transfer of wealth that is happening over time where people are acquiring businesses. That started a while ago. And when I started, it wasn't what it is today. But it kind of came into the limelight right around COVID. Because when COVID happened, there were all of these incentive programs and government programs, you know, PPP, EIDL loans, EIDL loans, things like that, that came out to try to revitalize or to keep the economy going, right? And people started to take notice of that. And SBA or small to medium-sized businesses kind of became a household name in a lot of places because of those programs. And while I was involved in PPP and EIDL and all of those sort of things, my bread and butter has always been the 7As, the 504s, the acquisitions, and the real stuff. Those didn't relate to the real stuff, but now everybody knew about the program.
Right.
And when everybody knows about the program, they'll see that it is actually quite an amazing program. The way to build wealth, it's a whole different story for some of these younger people coming out of college, is crazy with the terms that they can get. But it's kind of taken off and people started talking about it, particularly on Twitter, which is the weirdest thing to me.
Yeah.
But it's great. But people think it's so interesting. And now all of a sudden, this thing that nobody knew about when I started, they're all excited about it. I'm saying, guys, this has been around for decades. This isn't anything new, but it's a wave. And that wave that's been happening over time, I think, is going to continue into the future. But the changes that I anticipate are related to tech and related to AI and how those types of technologies are going to play out for lawyers, not only on the lender side. So like, how is my job going to be impacted by it for lenders, but also on the buy and sell side? So how is technology going to impact their ability to get the deals done? And a lot of it is going to have to do with how we work with technology to help streamline the process. And again, I don't want to get into too much of the details, but fintechs and all of these things that are being permitted now into the program, that's all changing. The barrier to entry for borrowers borrowing money is getting easier. I think it's going to continue. How it's going to actually impact us, it's really unknown, but we have to be able to pivot. And that's what I tell my team all the time is just get ready. It's changing all the time, but be able to pivot with it.
Yeah. And that's the challenge with being a lawyer, right? Is not knowing what's popular today or important today, but where are the clients going to be 7 years from now when you have 7 years of experience or 10 years of experience? And so maybe that was a good bet early on, but I think people are seeing this. And just like more and more people are going to come out of college wanting to participate in these government programs that allow them or facilitate them to be their own boss and own a business, there are going to be lawyers coming out of law school who want to be part of that economy as well. Is that what you're seeing?
Yeah, I mean, I don't see a ton of SBA attorneys out there. There are some that are known, and we all know them in the industry, but I haven't really seen it take off in the private space. What we see more taking off is what you said just then, the idea that somebody can go from a W-2 employee to an owner using and leveraging an SBA loan is becoming much more popular. And I don't know what necessarily that has to do with, but I think a lot of it has to come from COVID. The idea that people figured out they can work from anywhere. They don't want to be tied down to a 9-to-5. They don't want to do these types of things. They can own a piece of a business or own a business and operate it from afar or be in the trenches in that business and kind of control their own destiny. And that's a really popular sentiment that's been going around now. And I think it's going to continue even more so as the technology gets better, as we start to see those types of changes in the industries.
So are we going to see more SBA lawyers in the next decade? What do you think?
I don't know. I mean, the selfish portion of me says, I hope not. I hope they're working for me. But yes, I've seen more recently. And I think that's a good thing. There's enough work to go around. And I've talked to and mentored people from other firms and said, hey, if you're interested in this, let's have a chat about it. At the end of the day, there's enough work to go around. And we're all playing the exact same game. And the ultimate goal is to service these clients the best that we can. And to get those funds out there for the small businesses to continue operating, it benefits everybody.
Cool. Well, we're getting close to the end of our time. So I want to ask you one more sort of question before we get to the final question. Did you see that? That was a litigator trick where you ask two questions, but you actually say you're just going to ask one.
Okay.
And the first is one of the other things about, you know, we've talked a little bit about your public persona and how important that is to your practice. One of the things that you talk a fair amount about is being a husband and a dad and sort of how you integrate your work life and your personal life. And as a dad of young children myself, and a lot of listeners are either on that journey or plan to be on that journey someday, I guess I'd be curious if you could talk a little bit how you balance your family roles with your professional roles in a really busy legal practice.
Yeah, I think it comes down to organization and setting boundaries. Right. So the more organized you can be the night before or the week before, the better you're going to be able to execute at whatever that plan is. And in the lending industry, a lot can happen very, very quickly and deadlines can come up very quickly. So the more you can be prepared for that, the better. Tackle on the fact that you're in different time zones. Right.
Sure.
So organized, setting boundaries. And then just working when others are sleeping. I know that sounds incredibly hustle culture, and I'm not trying to promote that at all. But what's always worked for me is early mornings and later nights, because I'm never, ever going to sacrifice, you know, something for my daughter for work. I'm just not. And clients know that. They're not getting their matters. The ball's not being dropped. They know that I have somebody who has similar values, who's, you know, the same as me and will provide the same type of service as me on my team that they can go to if that's the case, right? So I'm not missing a soccer game ever, right? The client is going to be serviced, but I'm not going to miss it. I'm going to get things done, and I'm going to get done more when my daughter's asleep, when my wife's asleep, when people go to bed. All of those times are times when you can really capitalize on getting things done and getting organized. At the end of the day, balance is kind of a difficult word, right? And people throw balance around all the time. People talk about work-life integration and things like that. And I work a lot, and I work a lot of hours, but it doesn't feel like I do. And sometimes I'll have to ask my wife and say, like, am I working too much? Like, am I here? Am I present? And if she ever says, you know, no, you're not, that's time for me to reevaluate what's going on. But so far, it's been, I've been able to integrate it into my life. Hmm.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the things I hear pretty regularly on the podcast and think about myself is before the internet and before email and before phones and before Zoom, you kind of had to just be sitting at your desk in order to do your job. And that's just not the case for people of our generation. And there are negatives to that. Like, I will be the first to admit, like, one of the reasons I left practice and went to become an academic was in part because I wasn't getting enough margin for my family given my practice area. And it wasn't the right fit for me. I don't judge people who choose that, but it wasn't the right fit for me and for my family. All of that said, I stayed much, much longer than I ever could and was a much, much more successful father and husband because I knew that I could turn things off for a few hours at a time and then turn them on, even if my clients or my or the partners I was working for were asleep. And especially if you build that into your team, which it sounds like you have, right? When you have more people doing that, it actually makes it easier, not harder. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think one thing that you said that's really good there is that sometimes it's almost worse in the age of technology and internet and things like that because you're always available.
Yeah.
So being always available is difficult because there's always that, you know, I could just, you know, fire up the laptop real quick at 11 o'clock and do something. But
right.
should I?
Right.
I don't know. It depends on the circumstance. If a client needs something, yes, I will. I frequently fired up the laptop at 11 o'clock. But the pro to it is you don't have to be at the office. I'm not vouching that everybody should do remote work. There's value to being in person, especially in my industry. But at the same time, I could take a 3-week vacation starting today and I could still work. No matter where you're at in the world, you can still get something done. And for a working husband and father in the 60s and something had to be done at 11 o'clock, they were staying at the office until 11 o'clock. If you catch me at 11 o'clock at the office, there's something wrong, right? Mm-hmm. You need to call the EMTs. I'm never going to be here at 11 o'clock at night. I might work at 11 o'clock, but I won't be at the office. So I'll be home and I'll be able to do the things that I want to do, that I need to do to be a good husband, to be a good father, and all of those different things. But at the same time, if an emergency comes up, I can do it and I can do it remotely. It's not a big deal.
Yeah. And it's that waiting, right? You had to wait for an emergency at your desk. Whereas now if an emergent, like people find you, like I remember as a kid, even if there was an emergency with either, my mom was a rabbi, my dad was in finance. So people, they were working hard, but like if there was an emergency in the middle of the night in the '90s or in the late '80s, they had to call my house in the middle of the night and wake everybody up.
Yeah.
And it's just a different world and it creates different challenges as we've discussed. And those are challenges that our generation and the generation that comes after us are going to have to sort of rethink and reset and all of those things. Mm-hmm. But there are some benefits as well.
Yeah.
So look, I'm going to ask you the last question, although frankly, Scott, I feel like we could go on for hours. So I hope someday we can do episode volume 2, if you don't mind. But for the end of volume 1, I always end these conversations by asking for a piece of advice. And we're interviewing sort of the beginning of September 2023. We have a bunch of new law students. We have a bunch of new lawyers out in the world. What's something either you wish you knew when you started or something that you'd want to share with those folks who are just joining us in the profession?
Man, that's a tough one. I think, can I have 2?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay, I'm going to go for 2. I think the biggest one is to just come into law school or the profession and be curious and just be asking yourself, you know, where is the puck going? That's one of those common sayings, right? So where is practice going to be in 5 years, in 10 years, et cetera? And not just practice area, but how are lawyers going to work? What types of skills are going to make you stand out? You know, people think AI is going to take over all those things. We could go into that on a whole different section, but how do you work AI into your favor? How do you figure out how to leverage technology to be better, to be more efficient, to be all of those different things, and in what practice area? The other would be just try to find your fit as early as possible. Don't be worried if it doesn't happen quickly, but once you find it, don't look back. Immerse yourself in it and figure out, you know, how do you fit within that industry? How can you stand out in that industry? Whether that's trade associations, organizations, online, offline, et cetera. how do you become the go-to person, the thought leader, the one that stands out in that specific industry? And if you can answer that, you're going to have a very, very, very good, successful career.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Scott, for doing this. If you don't already follow Scott, find him on all the social medias, but LinkedIn, I think, is probably number one, right, Scott?
Yes.
And he's also out there in the world. And I will say, just on a personal note, he is one of those people who is being a thought leader, but trying to translate for those of us who are not in his industry necessarily as well. So if you're just curious, and I, for one, am curious about all areas of practice and how people choose to live their lawyer lives, I think it helps all of us. Go out and follow Scott, and hopefully we can do this again. So thanks so much for doing it.
I'd love to. Thank you so much, Jonah.
All right. Be well. Again, I am Jonah Perlin, and this is the How I Lawyer podcast. Thanks to podcast sponsor Law Pods for their expert editing. If you're a lawyer considering starting your own podcast, definitely check them out at lawpods.com. And thanks to you for listening. If you enjoyed the episode, I hope you'll consider sharing it with friends and colleagues or on social media. And of course, if you haven't already done so, please sign up for the email list at howilawyer.com or subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts. As always, if you have comments, suggestions, or ideas for the show, please reach out to me at howilawyer@gmail.com or @JonahPerlin on Twitter. Thanks again for listening, and have a great week.